From beach towels to tea towels, and from mugs to water bottles, the TNT Shop has it all. Browse our shop now at tntradio.live. You're with Trish Wood on today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
Hey, everybody, this is Trish Wood on The Fringe, and we're coming back into our interview with Thomas Buckley, who is the former mayor of Lake Elsinore, California. I hope I'm pronouncing that correctly, and a former newspaper reporter. He has written for Brownstone and the California Globe, Issues and Insights, American Thinker, Daily Skeptic, Heartland Institute, What's Up With That, Zero Hedge, Real Clear Politics, and more. He runs The Point on Substack, Yay, another brilliant Substack writer. That is the free speech platform, people, as is TNT Radio. So we're going to get back to him in a minute. I promised you a vaccine story, and so this is just an example of how the vaccine story continues to roll out in a way that is deleterious to moving the scientific knowledge ahead, right? We know it's not safe for everybody, and we know it's not effective. It doesn't stop transmission. So that mantra needs to be ended. But here's what's happening. There's a guy in one of the big universities in Alberta named Timothy Caulfield. He's a lawyer, specializes in health policy, and he's the guy that the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation and others go to when they want somebody to give commentary that's going to be on the side of the vaccine and the government's vaccine position. Prove me wrong. That's how he appears. He's never on TV criticizing the vaccine in any way, shape, or form. Timothy Caulfield is his name. And I don't have any reason to believe that his views are not honestly held. That's, I'm going to say that off the get-go. But here is where we are now. This is how corrupt science is. I'm not saying he's corrupt. He's talking about a study. But listen to this. So what moved on Twitter in the last 24 hours is a tweet by Timothy Caulfield that says, and declaratively, the biggest victims of long COVID are still the unvaxxed, study. And then one out of six unvaccinated people who have previously come down with COVID are not returned to normal health, blah, blah, blah. And then hashtag vaccines work, right? And so in the tweet, he runs an article about the study. The biggest victims of long COVID are still the unvaccinated. The study finds. So I did what most people on Twitter never do. I actually clicked through and read the study. I read it, or not the study, but the article about the study. And there's so much wrong with it. I mean, it's ridiculous that anybody would even comment on it, right? Even the article in Legacy Media, which loves vaccines, says the study does have its share of limitations. For one, the findings are based solely on a Swiss population, and they are based on self-reported health, which is less reliable than a doctor's appointment. Those unvaccinated individuals who didn't recover quickly were more likely to be older or having a pre-existing health issue. Well, those are pretty important things, aren't they? Isn't that what happens normally when old sick people get a virus? They're sicker. So it kind of ameliorates all of the findings of the study, but you have to click through. You've got to read this article. The article itself buries the lead. I didn't go through to the study. It may be even worse in the study itself. But this is how these wars are played out now in social media and legacy media, right? I'm just going to say it, this feels really dishonest. This is not a study that anybody should be quoting. Why is everybody in legacy media so aggressively wanting the vaccines to be better than they are and scaring people into getting them? Now we know that they don't prevent transmission. We know that they can cause harm, but oh, you'll get long COVID if you don't. I mean, it's very, very frustrating. And I can't even believe that somebody with Timothy Caulfield's credentials would have retweeted that in the way that he did, as if it was almost a fait accompli, right? And the other thing he did, just to give you a flavor, The Atlantic, which is not exactly an anti-vaxxer publication, did a story that said COVID shots are still one giant experiment. Well, yeah, they are, because the testing and clinical trials were foreshortened. Any honest person says that, right? His response was an unbelievably horrible and misleading headline. The Atlantic needs to retract immediately. It will feed conspiracy theories and hesitancy and do serious harm to public health. So this idea of vaccine hesitancy that's been part of the big censorship industrial complex idea, remember, the Stanford Virality Project were busted by the Twitter files when Matt Taibbi and the gang went in, and they discovered that Stanford was asking Twitter to censor vaccine bad side effects, even if they were true. And so if you ask them, they might say, well, that's because we don't want to cause vaccine hesitancy. So if you use your critical thinking and you pull that out, oh, okay, so we're going to lie to people about a vaccine that may be causing problems because we don't want them to get a vaccine that may be or because we want them to get a vaccine that may be causing problems. How is that normal behavior in a society that's got health protection branches and FDAs to prevent people from taking products that are going to, it's like the vaccines in American life and in many Western countries became a kind of a religion. I haven't made my podcast or my COVID coverage particularly about vaccines. I do some vaccine coverage with really, really credible people. But the other side, this just pushing and the heads in the sand and, you know, the tweets of, oh, I've had 5 boosters and I just got COVID. Isn't it great I'm vaccinated? That kind of crazy stuff. It's just mind-boggling. And I get very, very depressed when smart people like Timothy Caulfield are tweeting out studies like that and sounding definitive about it. It's just ridiculous. It is ridiculous. Okay, let's get back to Thomas Buckley, because he's a very interesting and smart guy. And I want to get to him about his piece on denialism. But we were talking just before the news about the idea that those of us who were wide awake and right and critically analyzing COVID and COVID policies felt very much at times like we were in some kind of mortal jeopardy in the neighborhoods and the countries in which we live. So he used the Rwanda analogy. I agree with that. Thomas, are you there? It's coming back.
Yes, I am.
Okay, great. So I'm glad you used, as I said before the break, the Rwanda analogy. I'm just wondering if you want to expand a little bit too on how you were feeling versus that historical perspective.
One quick thing about vaccines before we go on.
Yes.
I mentioned in before that because of the vaccine, which is not a vaccine, it doesn't stop the spread. It doesn't make you not get it. It makes you possibly health. It lessens the effects possibly. If the polio vaccine worked like that, we would have millions of people walking around with a limp. So I think that's one of the things you really have to look. It's a quick and dirty way to describe what the COVID vaccine actually was.
Well, let's stay with that for a minute, Thomas, okay. because I don't want to go after particularly this chap. I mean, look, I don't agree with virtually most things he says, but it's not just him. I mean, it's the whole other side of the way vaccines were handled, covered, spoken about, what you could say and couldn't say. People were literally twisting themselves into, not literally, I should have said figuratively twisting themselves in knots to defend this product against all comers, regardless of what the data said. How do you explain that?
Well, the vaccine was magic. That's what it was sold as. It was something that was going to end the problem that was caused by COVID. It was sold as magic. Therefore, magic requires a suspension of disbelief. Magic requires, and in reality, it requires a belief in the magic. So therefore, the reason people were kept twisting themselves in knots is because they had those two psychological issues going on in their head. And yeah. when you also you have to immediately unbelieve something and then you have to re-believe something, it becomes so you tend to dig yourself deeper into the hole and you glom onto anything that makes it possible for you to still think that you're kind of right. And in the end, as people have said, like that woman from Brown who asked for an amnesty, in the end, you could say, well, at least we were trying to do something right and you weren't. So you can actually still keep othering the people who are actually right about it by saying that, at least we cared. So I think.
So Brown woman the one who said we want a COVID amnesty? Is that the article yes. you're talking about?
Yeah.
Yeah. Was she involved in?
I wrote a response.
Oh, I didn't see that. Okay. Yeah. Go ahead.
Okay. She was, as a relatively obscure professor, and all of a sudden she got famous, and she was very much involved in pretty much every aspect of being in favor of the lockdown and pushing it. And then she said, we tried and we were really doing the best we could and we were really caring, but it didn't, let's move on. Let's we made some mistakes. So we'll just move on from there. I mean, first of all, if using their number purposefully, if 1 million people died and you were doing the best you could, you're not very good at it to begin with. The other thing is I compared it to kind of like the story I did was writing, going to a party, having way too much fun. Your wife is furious in the morning. You get over your hangover and you write a story in the Atlantic saying that that the silly stuff you did at the party should be excused under amnesty. It's the same kind of self-involved arrogance.
Well, it is, and what you just pointed out that's so smart is that where they fail, they blame the virus, right? So there's never any accountability. They don't say 1 million people died, so we must have made a mistake. They say 1 million people died. Wow, what a terrible virus. We must have saved 5 million people who didn't die. I mean, it's a shell game, isn't it?
Oh, absolutely. And especially if you go back to, there are certain things that seem to be real facts, except, okay, putting aside the died from COVID or with COVID argument, the death side is pretty much is countable. The how many people we saved side is all modeling estimates, all of which are very similar to the stuff that came out at the beginning of COVID, which said that everyone's going to die. So you can't actually figure out how many people didn't die. You can, however, get very close to figuring out how many people died because of the response, the people who didn't go to doctors, the people who developed psychological issues, addiction issues, et cetera. Those numbers, it's the excess death number. And if you look, the tighter the lockdowns were, the higher those numbers went. So.
You know what, you're right about that. And I live in Toronto, Canada, which was nearly as COVIDian as Australia, New Zealand, right? We were bonkers. And I remember, this is absolutely true, Thomas, and which is why your piece really resonated, the Nowhere Man piece really resonated with me, because I woke up one day and we were doing lockdown after lockdown after lockdown, and everybody thought it was really great. And the media was mad at people who didn't want lockdowns. We were baby killers, not baby, we were granny killers, you know?
Right.
And I woke up one day and I realized this simple fact. Our democracy had been handed over provincially by our premier to public health, right? These not very bright public health doctors. I've subsequently learned that public health is not where the geniuses go in medicine. I don't mean to be mean, but they're not the sharpest tools in the drawer. And what happened here, just mechanically, so you fully understand, because it happened a lot of places. What we have, an abdication of leadership by our political class, because they're afraid of getting it wrong. So they push the responsibility onto public health. Public health thinks their job is virus suppression at any cost. Nothing else matters. Cancer doesn't matter. Children's mental health doesn't matter. Nothing matters but suppressing the virus with lockdowns, which actually didn't work anyway, right? So that's where we were. And I woke up one day and I realized that we were no longer living in a democracy, that the court cases being entered into the docket to try to find a civil libertarian way out of this were failing, right? And that I am now living in an historical moment. Like I'm living, I will say this, I'm living in pre-Holocaust Germany. I'm not talking about the Holocaust. I am talking about the abdication by citizens to push back and the buying into a groupthink idea that is going to be a catastrophe. And there was nothing I could do about it. My husband, who's a great guy, had to get me out of here. We couldn't rent an Airbnb for 2 weeks. That was illegal, of course, because public health said it was. So we did find a loophole that said you can rent places for a month. So we rented a farmhouse in the country out of crappy Toronto, which was super COVIDian, and just went to the country for a month so I could pull myself together. Because there was a period where I thought, honestly, Thomas, I thought, I can't do this. I'm not going to make it. I'm losing myself here. It was really, really difficult.
Yeah, the psychology is, obviously, that's, if long COVID is a problem, it shouldn't, it's not actually the COVID. It's, we should call it long lockdown, that the effects that, that will be knocking on for years and years, education, psychology, health, the destruction of, institutional trust, public health operates. When I was on the, mayor of Lake Elsinore, you did pronounce it correctly. I was also on our I was on our mosquito abatement board, so I know it's a branch of public health, but we operated a lot on public cooperation and trust. That when, obviously, when you ask people to go, hey, once a week, drain your flower plants, your flower pots in your backyard, just to make sure you don't get any mosquitoes. They have to believe that you're not nuts, and making them work. And that's a huge problem for public health going forward, because, and I think you're correct, it's that, well, for a lot of people, when you go into a job, there's a certain amount of self-selection. You're good at it. You're interested in it. You may have a certain fear or phobia about it, so you want to fix it. That's where you get to the, so what you end up in with public health is, I think, a lot people, specifically what Los Angeles's director, Barbara Ferrer, was in a deposition 4 weeks ago in a room in a law firm with six people, and she wouldn't take her mask off. So what you have there, what you have are private pathologies, personal pathologies driving public policy. And you have electeds that sit there, and I've had people saying things at meetings and stuff like that. And the last thing you want is to someone to come up to you and hold a picture of their grandmother and say, you didn't do enough to protect this person, and now this person is dead. It doesn't matter whether or not she would be dead or not. Anyway, the trauma for the elected, and the therefore the electeds went, well, even Trump, who should have gone with his heart, his usual, you know, go to hell experts kind of attitude. You cede everything to experts. You cede it because, hey, they might actually have a clue. B, and if it goes wrong, hey, we did what we were told. And whenever you have an elected official hiding behind, we did what we were told, that's terrifying.
Well, and then that's why Ron DeSantis was so brilliant. And why watching this feud between the two of them is very, very disheartening. We got to go to a break. I want to pick up that subject when we come back, because I think it's important. Everybody thought Trump would be better on COVID. He did meet with the focus protection people. He did hire Scott Atlas. He did meet with Jay and the people who were Great Barrington and were absolutely correct and then didn't do it, even though I think his heart was in it. And now he's running around saying he saved the world from Neil Ferguson's stupid modeling that said 2 million people would die in 3. I mean, it's just ridiculous. So that's very disheartening for me, because Trump, I'm one of the few people who will say, I think Trump is right on many, many things he talks about, actually. And I know we're not allowed to say that without a caveat, but I'm just saying it. But you know, COVID was a big disappointment. And now he's going after Ron DeSantis for doing exactly what we all wanted him to do, right? So anyway, we got to go to a break. So we'll pick that up when we come back. I'm with Thomas Buckley, and this is TNT Radio. Back in a moment.
TNT Radio's Ross Cameron.
What is a human being? We are described in the taxonomy of animals as Homo sapien, meaning the wise animal. The animal that is distinguished from other animals by the use of reason. And it was the use of reason that gave the Greeks the feeling that the human being had a soul, because the human alone seemed to share this capacity with the divine to reason, not to be governed purely by instinct and by the behaviours of the herd. Yet we find, I think, both as we read history, but also in our own lives, that each of us is subject to both the influence of reason, but also the passions of the herd.
Ross Cameron on today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
For so many reasons, access to healthcare remains an enormous challenge for millions of children around the country. Imagine trying to manage a child's asthma while living in an urban homeless shelter, or growing up in a rural community where the nearest pediatrician is 3 hours away. Children's Health Fund has an innovative solution, a doctor's office on wheels that is actually a fully equipped mobile medical clinic. We go where kids need us most.
Visit childrenshealthfund.org to find out more.
A message brought to you by TNT Radio.
If you're talking about it,
over 6,000 migrants per day on average were apprehended after illegally crossing the border.
We're talking about it. Today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
Hey, everybody, Trish Wood back with Thomas Buckley, talking all things COVID, but kind of social COVID, like the damage to our societies and our neighborhoods and our brains is deep and broad. And I think two things are happening. One of them is that the really scared people who were scared by public health in order to make them obedient may never come back and take the plastic out of their apartments, you know, or hug somebody again. And the rest of us who were wide awake and saying, wow, how quickly we fell into tyranny. That took, about 30 seconds before we were all turning each other into the cops. So, yikes, it's not a good look for any of us. And I think it'll be, dare I say it, a generation. If we can learn from this and not do anything else that stupid again, it'll be a generation. But I fear that, you know, the door has been opened to all manner of hijinks from our globalist leaders. So we will see. But anyway, before the break, we were talking about Trump versus DeSantis and the way they handled COVID. Were you surprised, Thomas, about how quickly Trump seemed to cave, whether he actually caved or was pretending he'd caved? I don't even know what was really going on there. But what did you think of him?
I think one of the best summaries of what happened, actually, Jeffrey Tucker wrote on Brownstone about the issue of one day Trump is like, you know, it's Wuhan flu, we're going to be fine, etc. Has a meeting with a whole bunch of people in the military and the health bureaucracy. And the next day, things change. Something happened in that meeting. Now, if that something happened to be, hi, Mr. President, you know, this isn't a regular flu. We think it's bioengineered and it's from China. Then you can almost understand his, oh my God, we've got this could get really bad reaction. It makes more sense. And it also makes more sense why he was starting to push back a little bit when people realized that it wasn't that bad, especially it was attacking the same people, same demographic group that the regular flu did. So it was not, if you would bioengineer something like that, you would make sure it would do everyone, in theory. And he didn't. And he also had the political construct of, if Pfizer didn't put that 3-week delay to recheck a study, the announcement of the vaccine would have been a couple weeks before the election. He would have won.
Yeah.
Easy. There would have been no question of him winning. So he was politically counting on that. He was also made an error that I think a lot of politicians, particularly on the libertarian conservative right side, do, is that, ooh, if I do this, the press will say nice things about me for once. And the answer, they won't. The antagonism went from 10 to 8, as opposed from 10, if he had done something right, just staying at 10, except a lot more often. Spinal Tap goes to 11.
We have two Spinal Tap references in my show today. So that's amazing. Yeah, that's amazing. Yeah. Really glad to do that.
If anyone hasn't seen it, you have to watch it. And so I think, and of course, from a personality standpoint, he obviously can never admit that he never did anything wrong. There is that issue. True. And I think the Trump presidency was hamstrung from the first day, in part because of the people who worked for the Trump campaign. He may have been the only person who thought he was actually going to win. The Clinton campaign had literally spent $100 million hiring people for their government jobs that they were about to get. They vetted, they resumed, they knew who the assistant director of subregion B of the Bureau of Land Management Colorado office was going to be before the election. Trump didn't know who his Secretary of State was going to be. And so therefore he ended up, and because the Clinton campaign did that because they didn't want any of the Obama people hanging around. She did not forget that he beat her. So she wanted all those people out instantaneously. Trump was stuck scavenging staff from wherever. And thinking, oh, I'm president. It's like I own a company. People will do what they're told. Yeah. It's like, no, you're president. It doesn't mean people will do what you're told. So that entire thing hamstrung him. And then it comes to COVID, and he actually goes back and trusts the people that have been, screwing him for the last 4 years.
Yeah. So I mean, it's crazy. Yeah. It's crazy. I don't know how old you are. It's none of my business. But I will say
enough.
That we... Yeah, enough, right? But I don't think, I kind of lived through the end of the Vietnam War and other things, the women's movement, and I was one of the first women in news, and I've done all that stuff and through the bumpy times. But the last, I would say, since 2015 through until now, like 2:32 on Saturday. Yeah. Has been the most difficult, destabilizing, unpleasant time of my life. And I believe it's because all of the pillars of democracy that I believed in, albeit flawed, including news, I was a legacy news media investigative journalist for 25 years and a good one. All of those things are gone, right? And the attacks on Trump over Trump, Russia. I interviewed Jeff Gerth on my other podcast the other day, who did this brilliant piece for the Columbia Journalism Review, 4 parts, to total, like, how do you win a Pulitzer Prize for writing a story about something that never happened? I mean, we now know that if a populist president who's anti-war and wants to drill baby drill and fight the green agenda is elected, they will kill him. I mean, literally, maybe, for sure, figuratively, they'll shut him down, they'll impeach, they'll lie, they'll I mean, so I'm now coming to the conclusion that obviously politics in our country too, I mean, Trudeau is in his own way as corrupt as any leader ever in this country.
And say blah.
Well, and look at what
say blah. I wrote a story actually about the fact that Trudeau is the perfect example of why beta males should not be in charge of things.
Oh, I know.
Because they're so unsure of themselves. They overreact. They haven't actually done anything. They say the right things, but they know that they're not really an actual leader or someone that's really smart. They're just good enough. And when they get into a position of leadership, they can't handle it. So, I mean, there are so many beta males in the United States, the mayor of Portland, Eric Garcetti.
I'm sick of them. I hate them. I'm sick of them. So, yeah. I used to fly. This is a kind of a funny story, but I did a 5-part documentary for Amazon Studios on Ted Bundy, quite a big budget thing. It was quite good, actually, if I do say so myself. And it meant flying from Toronto to Seattle. The night flight is Air Canada, leaves about 8 p.m. from Pearson Airport and gets into Seattle at about 11, you know, because of the time difference, right? It was all beta male, big tech workers. So it was a plane full of people in their 30s wearing hoodies attached to their phones. And it was a real experience because I always had carry-on luggage. I never check luggage unless I'm absolutely forced to. But it was too heavy for me to put above my seat. And on most flights, a lovely toxic male will come and help me. And I'm always really grateful for it. But on those flights, they never looked up. They didn't feel sorry for me. They didn't help. So that's why when the truckers kind of said,
they may not have been strong enough to help.
Yeah, maybe. But that's why when the truckers happened, I thought, yeah, you know, the men are coming to the rescue. I shouldn't say that I'm a feminist, but that's how I felt. And they were that way. I mean, they were like, oh, screw this. We're going to go to Ottawa. And I thought, wow, someone's finally doing something, you know. But anyway, so I was just trying to make a point. And the point is just that it's been a very destabilizing period of time between kind of Trump getting screwed and living through COVID and everybody's lying. And ugh, like, it's bad, right?
Well, and you can see it almost as the fruits of what has been going on even before 2015, which I think you're about right. And it's not necessarily a generation, it's not Gen Z, millennial, but if you see someone in the 17 to 35 year old range, and I call them the censored generation because they grew up for the most part with very few challenges. Therefore, they have no idea how to deal with any challenges. And they're educated in a system that sees them as customers as opposed to students, and therefore they're not really challenged at that. So they end up they don't see the big deal about censoring things, because I think at the back of their head, it's like, well, if nobody can ever say anything mean, then nobody can ever say anything mean to me. Nobody ever can disagree with me. So you go back to that almost self-domestication process that I think has occurred. And dogs bark, wolves howl. So what you have is the howling is the communication, and they're not domesticated. Barking is attention. It's demand. It's do something. I mean, and dogs, I love dogs, but it's different. So, and dogs bark because they're domesticated. If you look at, for the most part, like wolf culture or whatever you want to call it, that there's a period, like, I don't know, 8-9 months, etc., that there's more barking in wolves. That's when they're adolescents. And what domestication does is essentially trap something in an adolescent form. So even though these people are getting technically older, biologically older, they've purposefully trapped themselves as domesticated creatures. And domesticated creatures get taken care of, and domesticated creatures do what they're told.
That's very smart. Did you see the video of Scott Atlas? He was giving some kind of a speech to some university students at a school in Florida. And I guess it was a commencement speech or whatever. And the kids got up, turned their backs to him, and started chanting, "Wrap it up," to drown him out. And I thought, what? Like, this guy volunteered to go to DC and help out with COVID, and this is what you're doing because your professors have told you to not like him? I mean, it was really shocking to me to see that. I thought, wow, how far critical thinking amongst our kids has fallen. And my fear is that they're all going to take places in the managerial class and then we're all really screwed.
Oh, yeah.
Because they're so indoctrinated.
We can already see that. Look at, you know, Bud Light. Because that the person in charge of marketing, young, like 30-ish woman, went to Groton, went to Harvard, very woke, very comfortable, always had. Now, why InBev hire? So that's the perfect person to market Bud Light is nuts. So she, not a person that kind of got the audience. So they did that. And she also, because she'd never been out of the bubble, had no idea exactly how incredibly infuriated people would be. She also didn't understand the brand, that Bud Light is the, not to be insulting, but it's the liquid equivalent of meh. You know, if you hand someone a Coors Light or a Miller Light instead, they're not going to care. So that makes the brand very, very vulnerable to stepping out of line in any way. It's not like Pliny the Elder beer, which is the best beer in the world. I mean, okay, they probably couldn't hire Hitler to do marketing for them, but they could get like, "Hi, this is Pliny the Elder. We're the official beer of the World Economic Forum. We're devilicious." And the and everyone who drinks it would be like, "Oh, that's fine. Of course I'm still going to keep drinking the damn thing. I know it's $16 for 14 ounces and but it is actually the best." So, that goes back to the people that are emerging right now who are worming their way through foundations and getting to the point of lower upper middle management and doing things like what Bud Light did, look at any Twitter feed. Most companies keep it. I just did a story on something called the California Endowment. Theoretically, it's a healthcare nonprofit, but they define healthcare as everything, and they define improving healthcare as community empowerment. And these people have $200 million a year to spend, $4 billion in the bank, and their Twitter feed features. Just a few days ago, had a poster on it that said, "Defunding the police is reproductive justice." And you're sitting there and you're looking at it and it's like, well, A, no. B, how does that match your message? And then you go, oh, no, it's because of the people they've got in charge of that. And it's particularly in the social media field, you do have very, very committed committed to the woke cause people in general.
Go ahead, Claire.
No, it goes back to the point that it's, if something doesn't happen, it will get worse just because there will be more and more people like that flooding the market. And
well, I think DeSantis has probably got it right, that we have to start defunding schools who are teaching this stuff, right? The critical theory has got to go. Just in keeping with your Twitter thing, there was a bank this week out of the UK that tweeted out a guy who works at the bank at some important job, who's also a drag person on the side. And he'd made this video, right? So he's a guy in drag and he's not even remotely looking.
We're not talking about RuPaul.
No, we're not talking RuPaul or Kris Jenner, any of those people, or what's his name, Jenner, Caitlyn Jenner, right? Caitlyn Jenner. We're not, I mean, she can sort of pass maybe on a good day, but this was a big fat person who wearing like a Minnie Mouse. I mean, just like ridiculous, absurd. And so they tweeted this out proudly, you know, for Gay Pride Month, blah, blah, blah. And what was great about it and what restored my faith in the culture more generally is the idea that the responses to it were all negative. And some poor little girl named Emily, who'd posted it and thought she was being all cool and stuff, was responding saying, "We don't tolerate transphobia and we will blah, 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 blah." And then eventually she just gave up and kind of stopped tweeting. But the responses to it were very, very enlightening. And we have to go for another break, which we will do now. I'm Trish Wood on TNT Radio, back in a second with Thomas Buckley. And we're going to keep talking about, I think it's kind of the degradation of our society by university students who are going to be graduating and taking their places really soon. So we need to be careful, people. Back in a moment.
Climate lockdowns have arrived. France is banning short-haul flights to combat the climate crisis.
From Washington, D.C., this is the Morano Minute with your host, TNT Radio's Mark Morano.
Here is CBS News reporting on France's government flight bans.
France has officially banned short-distance domestic flights in an effort to cut the country's carbon emissions.
The new law went into effect this week. It means people can no longer travel by air if the same journey can be made by train in under 2.5 hours.
The French government rejected banning flights up to 4 hours and opted to only do 2.5. The French citizens should be grateful. Is this just banning 2.5 hour flights to flatten the climate curve? Make no mistake, this is a war on freedom of movement. Every previous activity you may have thought you enjoyed, cheap, reliable energy, plentiful food, freedom of movement, are now going to be banned in the coming climate emergency. You were warned of these COVID-style climate lockdowns. They have arrived. Let's start the Great Reject. This is Mark Morano for the Morano Minute on TNT Radio.
Challenging the consensus and debunking the narrative. This is Viewpoint.
Do citizens make decisions based on evidence and reason? Or are they manipulated by behavioral economists applying nudge theory? In 1992, the Rockefeller-controlled Russell Sage Foundation launched the Behavioral Economics Roundtable. In 2008, two members of the roundtable, Cass Sustain and Richard Thaler, co-authored the book Nudge, which led to widespread government adoption of nudge theory through the Behavioral Insights Team. Also known as the Nudge Unit, launched in the United Kingdom, the Behavioral Insights Team now has offices worldwide, including in Canada, Latin America, the United States, Australia, New Zealand, and Singapore. The Nudge Unit boasts to have trained 20,000 civil servants and practitioners in behavioral insights. Supported by taxpayer funding, subtle messaging techniques nudge populations to normalize behaviors and attitudes deemed appropriate by nameless, faceless bureaucrats. The Nudge Unit plays on people's fears and guilt. It promises rewards for compliance in its projects, such as boosting vaccination rates and reducing energy consumption.
Trish Wood on today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
Yes, we did interview the British reporter who broke that story. She wrote a book about it called State of Fear, about how the British nudge units, also they happen in Canada too, I saw reporting on it, and they used fear to gain compliance in the COVIDian time, as I call it now. The problem is, first of all, that is highly, highly, highly unethical. Secondly, you can't unring the bell. So they scared the crap out of everybody to get them to comply, and now they can't unscare them. And I see those people in my neighborhood. There are people walking around with masks on and keeping their distance. And I had to go to the hospital for an appointment yesterday. The whole hospital was masked, except for me. And you know what? I didn't even get asked to put one on, which was sort of great. But those behavioral units are a disaster, and they're highly unethical. So maybe we should put that on our little citizens' bill of rights, that we're not to be nudged. We don't need to be influenced by lies. We need to be spoken to honestly, and we'll make our own decisions at the ballot box, right? So that's what we're doing. Hi, Thomas.
Hello.
Go ahead.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
what you were just talking about, I mean, it's very, very handy. A population that is constantly on edge is incredibly handy because it's very easy to promise things to people that promises that say, okay, you will not be so edgy anymore. When you're constantly in this state of psychological flux, especially societal psychological flux, it's so much easier to manipulate that society. So, yeah, that's just kind of going. So it's probably not going to go away soon.
It just shows how they're just, this was so awful. Like it really just highlighted how completely corrupt they are and how things can go south so very, very quickly. You know, we started this discussion agreeing with each other on how we went from thinking we lived in a normal community with friends and neighbors and we all shared certain values and everything was copacetic. And then the next thing you know, you're hearing, you know, the drumbeat of jackboots and the division of people in communities and your neighbors thinking you're a weirdo because you didn't wear a mask in the building. I mean, I had an incident happen in my apartment building where I walked in and a worker of some sort of delivery guy, I think, had come into the building not wearing a mask. And one of my neighbors said, we've got to find him. We've got to chase him. We've got to track him down and turn him in. And I said, like, we're not doing that here. you go, knock yourself out. But we're not doing that here. And it was like I had to draw a line. I couldn't participate in that. And you're either the person who sees how weird that is, you know, or you think you're being a great citizen by turning your neighbors in, right? And I know where I stand on that issue now. And it's not hard for me to figure out where I would be if things got really weird.
No, besides the societal issues, and they're related to societal issues, but the absolute guillotining of relationships among family and friends also added to that sense of unease, that sense of nervous exhaustion, that sense of, please just let me alone. Oh, if I do this, you'll just leave me be. I'll do it.
They said, you know, put on a mask and we'll open up, you know, take a vaccine, we'll open up, we'll lock down schools. The goalposts moved and moved and moved and moved.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. It would, because it was very convenient for people. You had mentioned earlier something about Australia, New Zealand, and Canada. And
yeah,
obviously the United States had ridiculous lockdowns, et cetera. But why do you think the former dominions seem to be really particularly nuts? Was there something, is there a commonality of former colonies? I mean, in Australia, they literally put people in camps, which was just and they're making them pay for it, which is just psychotic. Yeah. And they didn't even psychotic. Like, apparently they didn't let them like play or something, like have a cruise director, had them lead them in socially distanced Twister or something like that. And what is it? What was it about those three countries? Do you think, is it different or just, I always kind of watch that.
Yeah, no, it's a terrific question and anthropologists will be studying it for years, I hope. But here's what I would say, because it was a revelation to me. I used to be a very proud Canadian. I was proud we didn't have guns. I really liked our version of the National Health Service. I would go on documentary shoots to the States and be very kind of like lording it over. Oh, yes, well, you know, nobody in Canada who gets cancer loses their house because they've got it, you know, all that stuff. Yeah. And I thought, like, and bearing in mind, too, that I was, you know, voting very, very far left, you know, up until around 2015, right? So I was very proud of those things. And what I learned, I think, from COVID, well, really from the election of Donald Trump on in, that what I thought was a kind of, dare I say it, a kind of moral superiority, right? We stayed out of Vietnam. We're known mostly for peacekeeping. You know, we had troops in Afghanistan, but we didn't go to Iraq in the same way. So I just thought we were like less crass maybe than Americans were. And I would say this to you, Maybe cleaner, nicer, maybe better beer, but look at, I don't think any of that now, but I will tell you that mid COVID, I was going to buy a Lincoln Navigator with a gun rack on the back and head for Texas because the kind, what I thought was kindness is actually obedience. And that obedience expressed itself in the most awful ways. Our anti-vaxxer, in quotes, pushback in this country was absolutely disgusting. The media hated the unvaxxed. The health system didn't even want to treat the unvaxxed. People were turned away who were not vaccinated. There was a woman in Canada who could not get a transplant because she wasn't vaccinated. We did that here. We were one of the worst in the world. And I believe that what I thought was kindness is actually obedience and conformity. We are the hall monitor, Dewey Decimal culture of the world. And I think Australia and New Zealand probably is too. Look at Jacinda Ardern. I mean, insane human. Who would ever vote for her? I mean, what? We've got Trudeau, who's an absolute disaster. I'm rich adjacent. I live next door to the rich neighborhood, very rich neighborhood that all voted him in, you know, because he, in their view, looks okay and is spouting the politically correct talking points of the upscale dinner party now. It exposed something about Canada. I feel not connected to my country at all anymore, except for the people who rejected COVIDianism, and I feel very close to them, but everybody else I'm giving a very jaundiced look toward these days.
Well, with Justin, I mean, his dad invoked the predecessor of the emergency laws stop the, you know, to handle the Quebecois terrorism, and they were actually killing people, etc. Justin invokes the same law to put down a protest of people saying you're not doing things right that featured bounce houses. Again, that kind of goes back to the beta male, the absolute overreaction. And so I, years ago, I came up with this. There's that Lee Greenwood song, "Proud to be an American, because at least I know I'm free." Canadian version would be, "I'm proud to be a Canadian, where at least I know I'm fine."
That just about sums it up. Like, we were in line for whatever horror public health, you know, they were pouring ice on or pouring sand on outdoor hockey rinks for kids. A teenager was arrested by two cops who threw him down. He may have been tasered on an outdoor rink in Alberta in the middle of winter. I mean, this is our national obsession, not mine. I'm a basketball person, but it is our national obsession. I mean, it's like really crazy stuff was happening. It was all, I guess, bubbling under the surface here, and we just didn't know it, did we?
The Santa Clara County in California, California was nuts, and Santa Clara County was incredibly nuts. Doing sports analogy, they had a Monday night football game featuring the San Francisco 49ers, because they don't actually play in the city anymore, which is good for them. And it was during COVID, and since they were in the county, and there was nobody was allowed, obviously, in the stands, and Al Michaels and Chris Collinsworth were sitting in an outside booth to call the game, and the county health department said, "You have to wear masks while you're calling the game." And the fascinating thing is that they had the temerity to publicly say, they didn't even say stupid. They just said it's really irritating, it's really inconvenient, because they're announcers. And the next day were slammed across the media for potentially saying negative things about the lockdown. And they were sitting in a stadium of 60,000 people with nobody, and they were three stories up outside. And they were like, "This is silly. Oh, how dare you say it's silly."
Well, listen, I'm in the middle. We got to wrap it up here, so I'll just say this, then say goodbye. But I'm in the middle of a documentary involving some of the good scientists from Stanford, which is in Santa Clara County, Jay Battagieri and the group, Scott Atlas, those guys. And What I've learned is that Stanford was a hotbed of also of COVID insanity. These guys were punished and are still being punished to this day, shunned and
you know,
the worst ad hominem, just like they want to destroy these guys. So it's really interesting that Santa Clara County was the first county in America to lock down. David Zweig has done some great reporting on how bizarrely COVIDian Santa Clara County was. So it's almost no wonder that Stanford couldn't accept and felt that it had to reject the kind of dissident science of the anti-lockdown focused protection people, right? Like, it's a really interesting kind of microcosm of what went wrong. But we've got to go. And that means, Thomas Buckley, that I would love to have you back. And I think you should be reading Chris Bray. And if you're not, you should also probably be friends with him too, because you guys are both really smart and you're both living in California and have interesting, you have a Substack, right? Yes, you do, The Point. So
yes,
I'll have you back soon. Excellent. So thank you. Thank you very much for doing this. I'm really grateful.
Thank you so much for the invite. It's been fun.
Okay, thank you. So this is Trish Wood. I have a podcast also called Trish Wood is Critical. My Twitter is at Wood Reporting. I didn't get a chance to unload on Pride Month, but I will do it next weekend. I have a lot to say about that. And I hope I'll see you then. Thanks for stopping by. This is On the Fringe on TNT Radio.